For The Reason Podcast, I'm Zach Weissmuller. Today I'm speaking with Denise Ho, a Hong Kong-based musician and outspoken political activist who was arrested and later banned from performing in mainland China for her participation in protests in 2014. She's also been banned from performing in Malaysia for expressing her pro-LGBT views. Most recently, she's been involved in the recent weeks-long protest against the Hong Kong government, which were sparked in reaction to a law that would modify the region's extradition policy with mainland China, which activists fear would endanger Hong Kong's political independence by allowing dissidents to be more easily targeted. We'll get more into the specifics of that law and talk with Denise about what the increasingly fraught political situation in Hong Kong and her personal experiences as a political activist under such conditions have been. Denise Ho, thank you very much for joining us on The Reason Podcast.
Hello, Zach. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And first, I just wanted to get a little bit of background. Our American audience is going to be largely unfamiliar, but you are a celebrity in Hong Kong and other parts of Asia for your work as a cantopop artist. Could you just tell us what is cantopop and what drew you to that genre?
Yes, Hong Kong is speaking a dialect which is quite different from most of the regions in China, which is Cantonese. So the name cantopop, of course, derives from Cantonese and pop. And so this has been a culture unique to us since probably from the 70s. And so it has been in Hong Kong since then, and then so this is a genre that is from Hong Kong artists and Hong Kong people. So the fact that it is quite different is that we are more free to speak what we want to in our genre of music compared to what is happening in China, which is most of the people they have to be very careful, and they are censored in their music, and there are many issues that they cannot speak about. And so I guess this has been a very major change in the recent years, and it has also affected the cantopop recently because of the opening of the China market since the late 90s. And so even right now, like many of the people in Hong Kong, many of the celebrities in Hong Kong, they are refraining from speaking the truth because of fear of political reprisal from the communist government.
Hmm. And as I mentioned in the intro, it's my understanding that you've been banned from performing in mainland China. Do you have an idea of, you know, if your music is, I assume people are still able to get your music and listen to it over there?
My music is, in the major sense, it's off the shelves. But of course, people from China, they have ways to get over that firewall that has been built by the Chinese government in their internet. So, of course, I still have fans who can get to my music. And the most interesting thing is that people, they gradually find ways to overcome this issue, which is of course very difficult, but some still can do that, meaning that some of my fans, they will upload my music with different names, with different artist name, and try to still get my music on the shelves, and which is actually quite dangerous for them, because in China you really can get prosecuted for literally anything. Just someone, I think someone who spoke out for LGBT issues, just writing an essay, has been locked up for many years. And they just can do it really without any real reason. They can invent some reasons and then they can just prosecute you for that. And of course, with their very opaque judicial system, like you, even if it's obviously for political issues, they can really say it's for anything. Just like for Ai Weiwei, he was prosecuted, namely for tax reasons, but which is of course not true because everyone knew it was because of his political stance in his artwork.
What is it about your work that you think makes the Chinese government officials uncomfortable? Why have they taken your music off the shelves there?
It's mostly because of my participation since the Umbrella Movement for political issues. In 2014, we had a very, very big Occupy movement, which is probably historically the biggest movement in Hong Kong from Hong Kong students. And so what happened was that because of the interference of the Chinese government in our legislative system, where they tried to prevent us from having the universal suffrage that was promised to us in the basic law in the One Country, Two Systems that was introduced in 1997. And so originally we were promised that we can elect our own chief executive officer freely, but the Chinese government, they have been trying to prevent that, you know, in all sorts of way. And so in 2014, they tried to impose some rules onto this universal suffrage, which meant that they would be choosing some candidates for us to elect. So which means, of course, it's not a real universal suffrage. And so because of that, and because of many, many other previous issues that were slowly eroding the democratic system in Hong Kong, finally people realized that it is a very grave situation for us and we need to stand up. So in 2014, that was why many students, they came out into protest, and also some other people, they tried to start a Occupy Central movement, which was originally a smaller scale of a Occupy movement. But then on the 28th September of 2014, the police, because of the situation that kind of got out of hand for them, they threw a tear gas into the public, which, to give some context, Hong Kong is really a very, very peaceful place where nothing like this ever happens. I think the previous time that tear gas was used was in 1967, and at that time it was because of a cultural revolution movement in favor of the communist government. And at that time, some handmade bombs were made, and it was really a very violent situation. Comparatively to what happened on the 28th of September, people were really just, peacefully gathering on the streets without any weapons whatsoever. And so that really, enraged and awakened a lot of people. The 87 tear gas bomb that were thrown into the public from the afternoon until late night. And so I was one of those people who was enraged, and finally I decided to, to put aside my fears for losing the China market, and I decided to to just stand up and to stand with the students.
And so yes, that was the 2014 was the as you said, the Umbrella Revolution, which was named as such because of the umbrellas that the protesters held up to shield themselves from the tear gas that they were throwing. And you were arrested during that. And this is in many ways kind of the build up to what we're seeing now, or the beginning of what we're now seeing culminating. What was it like being arrested? How long did they hold you? And what was that entire ordeal like for you?
I was arrested and detained at the last day of this Occupy movement, which was 79 days after the beginning. And at that time, it was really the movement honestly, it died down because of, a lack of experience and also a lack of tactics from the students, which also, the government at the end, in the beginning, they were really making a lot of mistakes, and then they were using the police in a very careless way. They even got some gangsters to try to affect the students on the streets. But gradually, the government, they learned to, treat this whole movement in a more passive way, which reacted, the whole movement, it became a very loose movement, which in the end, like, people, they were leaving, and then most of the camps that were on the streets, that they were empty. And so finally we had to, just kind of surrender. And so a number of 140 protesters sat down on the last day, which the police, they came to clear the space. And so I was one of those people. But of course, that whole arresting and detainment, that caused quite a big stir up in the whole general public, because I think in our whole Canto Pop history, there weren't anybody who was arrested or detained for civil disobedience. And so that, that made a huge impact on the public. And so since then, of course, I was banned from China. And then some people, they voiced out their support, and they asked me if I wanted to, to elect for the Legislative Council and so on. So a lot of changes happened since then. And for me, of course, that was a expected outcome since the first day of my participation. I knew that I would be banned. And but the reason why I could be so confident in the participation and not refrain from that, because I knew that I had a very strong fan base, which means that, with tools of the internet, with the ways that I can do it through social media, and even I can sell my own albums and tickets directly to my fans. So I knew that with all these changes in the whole market, even if I was banned from many mass media, and even I was feared by a lot of different brands and businesses, and even other celebrities, I knew that I could still survive, as long as I have the support of the public.
And I want to bring this up to present day now to talk about the protests that are happening. But just real briefly, just to flesh out your bio a little bit more so everyone understands where you're coming from. In reading a little bit about you, I found that you were born in Hong Kong, but grew up in Canada before returning to pursue your music career. How do you think growing up overseas affected your political views, if at all?
Oh, of course, that has a huge impact on me, in the sense that my values and my priorities are quite different from the most of the people in Hong Kong. Because Hong Kong is a very materialistic society, which most of the people, the way that they have been educated is that success means that you earn a lot of money and you gain fame and just position in the society, which of course is quite different from my education in Canada, which values the individual, and also which values the freedoms and the human rights and all sorts of liberties that the Western world has been emphasizing for quite some years. So with this mix of a Chinese culture and also this Western culture, this Canadian culture, it made me, more, I put more importance on the fact that I could express myself freely, and also in face of these injustices, I would choose to stand up. So, you know, most probably in Hong Kong, people might, especially my colleagues and, you know, people in this industry, they probably think that I'm crazy, you know, for speaking out in these ways and, you know, sacrificing my career because of something that is probably not so important to them.
Well, I want to briefly summarize what is going on in Hong Kong right now so we can talk a little bit more about what and why this transpired. So I'm just going to briefly summarize it, and maybe you can just fill in any gaps or context right. that I'm missing. Yes. My understanding is that a young Hong Kong man and his pregnant girlfriend traveled to Taiwan, presumably on vacation, and then the young man admitted to murdering the girlfriend and fleeing back to Hong Kong. And Hong Kong doesn't really have a formal extradition agreement with Taiwan, so they can't, and they can't charge him in Hong Kong since it didn't happen there. So the governing body of Hong Kong, under the leadership of the chief executive, Carrie Lam, who we'll talk more about later, proposed a bill that would allow the transfer of fugitives on a case-by-case basis back to places where no extradition agreement was in place. And then where the controversy enters is that this would seemingly allow the Hong Kong government to extradite people not only to Taiwan, but to mainland China, and that could potentially open the door for political dissidents to be sent there. Is that about right? And are there any missing details or additional context people should know about?
Yes, that is right. The reason why they have tried to make these amendments to the extradition bill is because of this case, you know, on the surface, I must add. Mm-hmm. And the way that they have put this, to try to make this justifiable is the, you know, they try to say that it's a loophole in the extradition bill, which does not allow Hong Kong to extradite to certain countries. Most of all, you know, China has been excluded, which is not true because this is not a loophole. This was specifically designed to exclude China when this whole basic law was put into place in 1997 when we were handed over back to China, and then the one country, two systems was put in place. And, you know, to give some more context, Hong Kong is a special administrative region, which means that this, we are a city in China, which we have a separate system, a whole separate currency. We have our own chief executive officer, and supposedly we have this autonomy that was promised to us. So we can decide our own issues. We can make our own laws and so on. And so the fact that this extradition bill, it was designed specifically to leave out China, is because if we do not have this firewall between Hong Kong and China, then China can, you know, they can choose to extradite anyone as they please. They could request it to the Hong Kong government, which, you know, if we really had this autonomy, it might be a less concerning issue for Hong Kong people, but because of this declining autonomy, because of this tightening grip from the Chinese government, which is quite obvious, that which has become quite obvious in the previous 22 years, where we have seen, you know, some booksellers being kidnapped directly from Hong Kong to China, and then they would be reappearing in TV stations, on TV in China, admitting to crimes that they have not really committed. And then there were these, since the Umbrella Movement, there were these lawmakers who were disqualified because of, you know, really quite ridiculous reasons. And it was obviously, of course, because of political issues. And so because of all these things that have been happening in Hong Kong, people have been very, very concerned of this extradition bill, as this would be really the last line. You know, we really would be falling off that cliff of Hong Kong becoming just another China city if these amendments in the extradition bill passed. And of course, this is also a very global issue where it would not only affect Hong Kong people, it would really affect anyone, any tourists, any people who would be passing by Hong Kong, even by transit, say an activist from another country or an NGO staff which would be working against Chinese human rights, for Chinese human rights. And so this really endangered a lot of people who might be passing by Hong Kong, and they could just be extradited for national security threats and so on.
And yeah, you mentioned that when the UK, which maintained colonial control over Hong Kong for more than 150 years until 1997, when this agreement was made, that agreement that established Hong Kong as its own administrative zone is supposed to last until at least 2047, so 50 years. But you're saying that the sense there among Hong Kongers is that this agreement is not being upheld. And how did you say for about 20 years you felt the kind of tightening grip? Is that about the timeline, or has it really intensified? Was 2014 a big inflection point for that?
Yes, you're absolutely right on all of these points. That grip has been slowly tightening. Like in the beginning, since the 1997 handover, it has been seemingly quite normal, for Hong Kong people, that the economy was fine, and then we still had many of the freedoms that we had. But then gradually we saw the change, like the Chinese corporates, they bought some of the newspapers, and then one of the our major televisions, they have been slowly silencing and self-censoring themselves. And so, people saw the changes gradually. The way that the Chinese government, they have been trying to control the media, and also the censorship that they have been putting on us through the fact.
What kind of things have they been doing to control the media and censor?
We have 8 major newspapers. And originally, all of these newspapers, they could just write freely whatever they wanted. But then right now, I think 5 of them have been bought, 5 or more, I think, have been bought by Chinese corporates. And so, you can really see it in times of major issues where, say, we had a march during the last few weeks. And then these newspapers, they would be twisting the facts. Like they would be writing, they would not write about it completely, or either they would change the fact, and then they would use these pictures and state that it were people in support of the Chinese government. So that's what's happening in China, and so it's slowly creeping into our own Hong Kong media. Luckily, we still have one major newspaper, the Apple Daily, which is more pro-democratic. And there are 2 others that is sort of, sometimes they say the truth. So we still have that, but it's really a very, very grave situation for Hong Kong people.
So the promise of that one country, two systems arrangement was that there would be economic freedom, and that seemed to play out. I mean, Hong Kong actually has a higher per capita GDP than the US, according to the IMF. And then from that, the political freedom, the theory was that the economic freedom would come first, and then the political freedom would flow from that. Do you feel like it has worked out that way? To what extent has that actually happened?
Well, I mean, we still have that system in place where, we can trade freely with the international world, quite different from what is happening in China. Like, they have many regulations, they have many things that are happening internally, where you cannot really do business as freely as you can in Hong Kong. So, which, you know, is something to our advantage, because we are still quite a very important portal for China to get into the international world. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, many businesses, many businessmen, they have been very careful about what they say and, you know, how they express themselves on political issues, because of that control of the Chinese government, you know, over them. Because these businessmen, they still have to have, they have businesses in China, within China, and that is a very huge market for them. And so, you know, in the case where someone who might choose to speak up, you know, against the Chinese government, then they would be punished in China, within the China market, where, you know, most probably they cannot have the, those advantages that they are having right now. And so on that level, I think we really do not have all that freedom that was promised to us. Mm. You know, even, and that also, of course, affects the entertainment industry, where most of the celebrities, especially the most popular ones, where they can earn a living in China, they would really be totally silenced. You know, just quite recently, just last week, I think, some of the celebrities, they chose to post photos on social media when this young man, he fell from a building because of you know, his stance. He was protesting on top of a building, and then he fell. And so, you know, some of the celebrities, they chose to post really a very neutral photo, like, they just wrote "rest in peace," and they were forced to take down these photos on social media, on Instagram. And, you know, that is what is happening in Hong Kong. And in cases like, in situations like these, of course, the Hong Kong audience, the Hong Kong public would be unhappy about it, and then they would, you know, throw comments at these people, these celebrities. And at the same time, Chinese audiences would also be unhappy, and then they would be scolding the these celebrities. So it's really a very common situation since probably these last 10 years, where celebrities, they really have to be very, very careful with these so-called sensitive issues.
I mean, you mentioned that there's a kind of culture of materialism there, which is understandable, because when you're, you know, first, when a country is first making a lot of money, then these material goods, it makes sense that they would be very important to people. Do you feel at all, I mean, looking at these protests though in the street, it seems like at least a large segment of the population is kind of, I don't know, waking up politically. Is that an accurate assessment? Is there some sort of cultural change happening right now?
Yes, absolutely. The change is really very amazing. If you know what happened during the Umbrella Movement, and then what happened the 4 or 5 years afterwards, where there was a lot of anger and disappointment, and with the way that the government, they have been handling things, the way that they have become really tone deaf to a lot of what the people had to say, which resulted in young people checking out and people becoming numb to a lot of political issues. Mm. And so, you know, it has been a very gloomy 5 years for Hong Kong people, because from what we had, this climax that we had during the Umbrella Movement, and then we dropped into this indifference once again. So I guess nobody really expected this huge comeback of all these people, especially younger generations, who came back onto the streets, and also they showed this improvement in the way that if in the Umbrella Movement people were very biased, and then they were, you know, there were a lot of arguments whether, you know, how we should do it, and some people were sticking with the peaceful side, the non-violence side, and then some younger generations, they were claiming that non-violence was useless, and then they tried to do it in a more aggressive way. And so this time around, people are learning from the mistakes, and there is a sense of a coexistence among people with different views and different stands, and which is really, really very moving for me, because, you know, I have been, during these 5 years, I have been emphasizing the fact that we really have to, first of all, become very accepting of people with different stands and different tactics. And secondly, for the way that we have to regain this momentum is that we have to become very flexible and very creative in our ways in the fight of the democracy, and which is really happening right now. Like on the first day of this huge movement, we could see people changing their tactics. There were cars on the streets trying to stop the traffic and helping the protesters, and then people were changing their spaces. They were no longer occupying one particular space, but instead, like, they're changing tactics and then changing the space and then going into empty aisles and then moving from one space to another. So really, it's a upgraded version from the Umbrella Movement, and you see the way that these young people, they are, you know, they might launch this action one day, and then if it worked or if it didn't work, they would still gather in the end of the whole protest, and then they would try to talk about it, to discuss about it, which never happened in the Umbrella Movement, because at that time we had the student organization who really led the whole movement. And so this time around, the most unique thing about this movement is that we don't have any particular person as leader, and neither organization which is leading the pact. It's a very organic movement where people can pitch in, and then the most original or most creative idea would be chosen, and then they would go with the thing at that time. And it changes. It's very fluid.
There's been a lot written about China's surveillance state, which seems just completely all-encompassing and overwhelming. How is that playing into this, if at all? I mean, I imagine as someone such as yourself, who is one of the public faces, that you must worry about being surveilled by the Chinese government. So how do you deal with that issue?
Yes, this issue has been, you know, arisen from the Umbrella Movement, where previously we were using communication apps, you know, from China. Of course, we use WhatsApp and, you know, Facebook and all that, but we also have Weibo and WeChat, which is a Chinese version of WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, they work, of course, is that it's monitored and surveyed very, very closely. And there were cases where, you know, people might be talking about very sensitive political issues, like, for example, the June 4th Tiananmen massacre that happened. Like, they would be putting these words out, they would write these words out, and then these messages would be disappeared. It would be erased. And so, of course, on Weibo, also the Twitter, Chinese Twitter, and, you know, all these messages would be censored. And most recently, the word Hong Kong cannot be even searched on Weibo. And so, of course, we know that the surveillance is on. And personally, I deleted the WeChat app since 28th September in 2014. But, you know, you really cannot block everything. Yeah. I have made phone calls, you know, with these more prominent figures in the movement, and I have heard the phone calls. You know, there are these clicks and these delays, and obviously, you know, it's been being monitored, and so we try to use different ways. You know, we try to gather in person as much as possible if it's really talking about more sensitive issues, and you know, we have to change apps all the time. Like previously, it was from WhatsApp to Telegram, and most recently, I think Telegram has also been hacked. So like fortunately we have apps coming up all the time, and so I guess we just have to go with the flow.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that there have been a number of, for instance, booksellers who have been dragged out of Hong Kong into China, presumably for selling books that the government doesn't like, although under usually other pretenses. I mean, do you live in any fear of something like that happening to you, given that, again, you are a prominent figure in this movement?
Well, of course, I have some measures. Like, say, I will not try to go into China.
Yeah.
First of all, because to give some context, I have been banned, like sort of officially, but in China, you really never have this official list. Like they won't put out a list where they say, oh, so or so people have been censored and banned. So like I have another friend, another celebrity who has voiced out his opinions. He had tried to go into China, and he could get into, I think in 2015, he went to Shenzhen and he got in and he came back. But of course, you know, myself, because I was arrested, and so I have the record, and so I will not try to go into China. And neither would I go into Macau, because Macau is also a SRR, Special Administrative Region, but still, you know, they have been also very controlled by the communist government. So you know, with that said, I think I am, you know, comparatively to other activists, I am in a more safe position because of my celebrity, and also because of the fact that I think the government, they are not as stupid as we might think. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if they really kidnapped me or, you know, tried to do something to me, it would really make a very, very big news. And so the way that they are doing it, they are trying to intimidate those people who don't have the spotlight on them. And so I think my fear is more for these people, because, you know, from what I know, that this is not a very official statement. You know, from rumors, there were sayings that people have really been kidnapped a lot. And I also have some friends who have this experience where they have been, you know, brought into China, and then they have been intimidated, and, you know, most probably they had some businesses, or they have some issues, and, you know, family issues probably, and then the Chinese government, they would hold this against them. And so when they would be released, and then when they come back, they would be silenced. So you know, that is something that is a very real threat that is happening right now in Hong Kong. And so it would only worsen. And that is why people have been standing up and then coming back onto the streets against this extradition bill, which would make all this kidnapping quite legal.
And how exactly do you view the relationship between the Hong Kong government and the Chinese government? I mean, you mentioned earlier that it's your belief that the executive board, I guess, is more or less at least some of them have basically been appointed by the Chinese government. So, I mean, how much independence is there at this point? Are there a few people on there who, you know, you feel like are on the side of an independent Hong Kong, or is it totally corrupt and colluding with the Chinese government? What's your analysis of that at this point?
Well, there are two levels to this whole structure. There is the government, and also there is the Legislative Council, where half of this Legislative Council is elected by Hong Kong citizens. So on the level of the government, from what I see, it is really like probably 99% pro-Beijing, which... No, it wasn't really like that previously. Like we still had some officials in the government who were more neutral. Like they would sometimes speak up for people on our side, on the pro-democratic side. But in recent years, after Carrie Lam, the chief executive officer right now, has been on to the stage, you can see all these officials, all these people from the government, whenever they come out to speak, you know, they just would not address these problems directly. And they would use all sorts of tactics with their words. They would promise something, but it would not be done. So gradually, they lost the trust in the public. And so that is why, you know, Carrie Lam, she spoke up, I think, after the march on June 16th, where we had 2 million people on the streets. And so she apologized, and she first she suspended the bill, which, of course, is a tactic from the government where they could pick up the bill whenever they wanted to. And so that was why people did not accept the apology, and they did not accept the way that they put it. And we demanded a retraction of the bill. And so that is why the protests are still going on, even, you know, right now. Like today we have this protest in Central in support of the people, and also addressing the G20 meeting that is happening in Osaka on Friday, on June 28th. So, that on that aspect, like we really do not have any hope for the government side. But of course, on the Legislative Council side, there are still hopes, because the next elections are happening next year. And so we are working very hard to get people to register to vote, and we are trying to mobilize as many votes as we can, because, you know, in previous years, the younger generations, the percentage of the voters have been very low, because people don't really understand the importance of, you know, the Legislative Council, which really is a firewall between the government and, you know, the Chinese government, because they really can, the chief executive officer, she cannot change any laws without the approval of the Legislative Council. So our next battleground is the Legislative Council. So if we can gain back the majority of the seats on the elected side of the LegCo, then we might have hope in changing some things.
You mentioned that Carrie Lam, the chief executive, did apologize and postpone debate on the bill. And so are your demands at this point boiled down to just a complete retraction of the bill, taking it off the table? Or is there anything else that the protesters are demanding?
Yes, originally we were demanding for Carrie Lam to step down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, finally, we boiled down to, first of all, the retraction of the bill, and secondly, the police violence that happened on June 12th, we want this to be addressed, because they used excessive force on peaceful protesters who, you know, really had nothing in their hands. Like, we did not have weapons, and, even in some images, we saw people turning their backs to the police, and the police, they were firing tear gas onto the people. And so we are demanding for this to be addressed and to be reviewed. And so, and also for the label of the riot, the word they used was that this was a riot, which was absolutely not true. Because for a protest to become a riot, we really had to have real weapons on hand, which we did not. Like, we had in some particular places, there were a few students who grabbed bricks and then they threw it into the crowd, they threw it into the police. But, you know, with the full gear of the police, that was not really a cause for to naming this whole protest into a riot. So we are demanding for this label to be taken off, and also for those who were arrested to be released, and to not be prosecuted.
And then, just taking a step back, how do you feel about the future of Hong Kong's independence, given all these issues we've been talking about, the encroachment of Chinese influence, the kind of growing power of the Chinese surveillance state and all of its technological capabilities, the way that President Xi has really consolidated power? Are you optimistic, or do you think that it's just a matter of time before mainland China does really try to assert control, and there's some sort of, tipping point?
Well, to clarify something, we are not really asking for Hong Kong independence mm-hmm. right now. We are just asking for, our autonomy
right.
back,
okay.
which is quite different, because the autonomy was promised to us, yeah. as I said previously, in the One Country, Two Systems. And so we are legally binded to that.
Right.
And so personally, I think, of course, it's a very difficult situation where, as long as we cannot elect our own chief executive officer, as long as she or he is appointed by the Chinese government, then that is still a very big barrier to our autonomy. But, on the brighter side, I think with the people standing up in such a fashion as we saw these last 2 weeks, and with the way that you see the Hong Kong government, and also in behind that, the Chinese government, they have backed down because of all these people who came onto the streets. You can see that they are not really completely not unfearful of the people. And the fact that Hong Kong is still this financial hub and this financial portal for China mm-hmm. Into the international world, and with the trade wars going on between China and US, and also with China trying to become this powerful country, at least to become head-to-head with the United States, I think it's really a very different situation compared to in 1989, where China, they could, really used excessive ways to silence the people. And so they cannot really do that, and when they really are still trying to put up this front to the whole world, where they try to convince people that they respect human rights and blah blah blah, and I think that is something that works in our advantage in the sense that they cannot really interfere in a very obvious way. With that said, I think there are changes that are possible, anytime.
Yeah.
And as long as people keep this momentum and then keep this belief, and especially the younger generation, as long as they can hold this and not get discouraged, I think really anything can happen.
Yeah, and you're right that the communications technology, I guess, has really changed the game in some sense. The entire world is watching this. There's a lot of interest in America, I can tell you. Americans like myself are watching and rooting for the people of Hong Kong to prevail and keep authoritarian forces at bay. And I want to close on that note because there's a G20 summit coming up next weekend, and the Chinese government has said there's to be no discussion of the protests there. I mean, is there anything that would be particularly helpful or unhelpful for, I don't know, the American government or international observers or just regular Americans to do? Or is this just something that really only Hong Kongers are in a position to fight?
No, I think it really is a very global issue where when you see this powerful country controlling a lot of the economic side of the whole world, but on the other hand, they are abusing human rights and then they are really not on the same length as most of the more progressive countries. And so, you know, in this sense, I think not only Hong Kong is at stake, it's really the global community is also at stake. You see these countries, they are refraining from speaking up because of fear of, you know, economic reprisal. And so I think, you know, at the summit, of course, it's a very, very important space where those countries who have already chosen to voice out their concerns about these issues, I think it's a very important space where they can address China directly. And of course, on the other side, it's the United Nations, the Human Rights Council. I think there's a lot that they can do, you know, concerning the Hong Kong issues or the China issues. And so, and also, you know, on the very grassroots side of this is that you see that a lot of people in different countries, a lot of activists and a lot of protests are happening, such as in Taiwan. The elections are coming up, and then you see the effects of the protests in Hong Kong. It has changed the game, where Tsai Ing-wen, the president at the moment, she was actually falling behind in the polls, but then the protests in Hong Kong happened, and then she came back onto the first position in the polls. And so you see this is a very connected thing that is happening within Hong Kong and also within different communities in the world. I had this activist friend from Armenia, I think, you know, she voiced out her support to me, and she mentioned that this that is happening in Hong Kong is very empowering to them, where they can use us as an example to address to the people and to tell them that, you know, non-violence tactics are still working in some way. And so for me, this is a game changer, where, you know, something that happens in Hong Kong, it can affect something that happens in Taiwan or in Armenia or Bulgaria, whatever. And as long as, you know, this momentum keeps going on, I think it's something that is very in the advantage of people fighting for human rights.
Well, yeah, everyone is watching and hopefully learning something from this. And I wish you and your fellow protesters the best of luck, and hope you can stay as safe as possible out there. And just want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today, Denise.
Thank you so much, Zach.